to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams, and today on the show, it's the Olson-Dakari duo. They are John Olson on the guitar and Joya Dakari on vocals. voice, I should say. And this Saturday, December 12th, you can join them. Details are on their website. That's OlsonDakariDuo.com. That's OlsonDakariDuo.com. Saturday, December 12th, you can join them where they will be sharing with you the premieres of two of their videos, Seagulls by David Leisner and Archimedes by Andrew York, as well as a presentation of some of their work with the great composer Clarice Sisson. That's all going to be this Saturday, December 12th, OlsonDakariDuo.com for more details. I have a great discussion with them. If you want to hear me talk more about John's role with the Classical Guitar Society, there's a great episode from probably 7 or 8 years ago, one of the earlier ones. I'd say they're in the top 20. we talk about sort of the challenges of a guitar society at that point. Since then, not unlike Matt Hensley, he's taken a relatively small operation and transformed it into a cultural force that the city depends on. So, we sort of talk about how grateful I am to him for doing that. And I think we should all sort of share our gratitude with everybody who runs these societies, which are often volunteer positions. The show is sponsored by SavageClassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. You can go there and Richard will hook you up with the guitar of your dreams. You can tell him that I sent you. That's Richard Sage, SavageClassical.com. He is the best on the East Coast. All right? Love that guy. Also, if you want to learn the language of your choice, you can do it with RosettaPodcast.com/insider. Don't go to RosettaPodcast.com. Go to RosettaPodcast.com/insider. And you can get a membership for $200. You can learn unlimited languages, or you can get a subscription for under $10 and learn the language of your choice. That's RosettaPodcast.com/insider. I hope everybody's doing good. I'm doing pretty good. It's, Hanukkah is going to be on the 10th. Christmas, of course, on the 24th. So we've got a lot to look forward to, right? I'm going to be stuck here in New York. This is going to be my first Christmas by myself. I think so. I'm not going to be completely alone. I got a little buddy. I got somebody that I'm going to be, hanging out with and keeping warm with, and that's a good thing. And we're both going to be separated from our families, our moms and our dads and stuff. So that'll be sad, but I think it'll be new and interesting. An actual New York Christmas Day. That's something I have not experienced. I think when I was in Austin, I did Christmas Eve once, and I woke up, and I was all by myself. And I got to tell you, I loved it. I don't know. There's something about it. I think New Year's Day, I was in San Francisco this year, and I woke up, and I was completely alone. My friend Peter was still asleep, and I just went for a jog up in those hills there, and it was really foggy that day, and it was just a real magical experience because we got in earlier. Peter can't drink too much. He's sort of a lightweight. He sort of fell asleep at the bar. We sort of got kicked out of the bar. So, I mean, I was able to go back and sort of toast the new year by myself. It was a little awkward, but, people actually were really nice about it. They took care of me. They were concerned for me because I was there alone on New Year's Eve. And this all sounds terrible. This all sounds terribly bad, but it was actually a great year it was a terrible year, but it was supposed to be. I thought it was the beginning of a year of sort of, that was the first, holiday season where I really felt happy to sort of have my freedom and I felt like I had sort of a lot of things to look forward to. And then COVID hit and I guess that all went in the toilet. That's not true. Some good things came out of this. We'll talk about that. Two of them are these videos that they made. They made them all by themselves. I didn't know that. Unbelievable. So anyway, so this is going to be a new experience. I'm going to get a little tree. I have permission from the school that I work at, the best school in the world. I got permission from them to have the tree in the background. So I'm excited about that because it's not a Christian school. They celebrate other things, and I celebrate with them. So I'm happy for everybody. Is everybody excited for Hanukkah and Christmas this year a little bit? I think it is. I think we have to be. Man, it's going to be tough being quarantined in these little apartments, but it'll be all right. We'll get by, right? Anyway, if you want to, please support the show. It's the end of the year. Now, I don't know. You can ask your tax guy about whether it's going to work out or not for you, whether or not the IRS is going to come knocking on your door if you donate to the show and then write it off. I don't know. I can't help you there. But I think it's always a good time to write, to write me, tell me how you're feeling, what you're doing. And you can do that at brett@brettwilliamsmusic.com. Please let me know how you're doing. If you want to hear from anybody, if you think I should interview anybody, I'm always looking for guests. So there's that. You can always donate to the show. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com, B-R-E-T, one T in Brett, brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Okay, we could use all the support, all right, so that I can get everybody the Christmas presents that they need, that they desire. My brother will be in town too, so I'll be celebrating with him. It's not going to be that bad. It'll be okay. I worry about my parents being alone on Christmas. That makes me sad. Won't be able to see my niece and nephew either. By the time I see them, they'll be 9 and 6. That's completely different than 8 and 5, if you know anything about kids. So I'm missing out on a good year with them. 8, you know, they're still babies. Let's get on with the show. Here's my time with John Olson and Joya Dakari. All right, guys, so how are you doing? It's good to see you again.
Good. Great to see you.
I know I don't come to enough shows. That is a topic of, you know, constant conversation with me and Simon. We talk about it, and I want to come to more shows. I know that you guys have a show coming up on December 12th. Is that right?
This
weekend, right. And that's Saturday, Saturday night?
Saturday night, 8 o'clock.
Yep.
And the big thing we're talking about today are the two new videos, which came out featuring the music of David Leisner, not David Starr, but David Leisner.
Right.
David Leisner and Andrew York, two of our favorite composers, and certainly people that you know a lot about, that you've worked with in the past. And, you know, David Leisner is, of course, here in New York City. And that's a guy who goes to every show.
Excellent attendance record.
Right. I'm basically failed out of school at this point. But you know, those two videos, I saw them and they're really outstanding. They have both of them have beautiful cinematography, beautiful playing. Wonderful performances, wonderful acting by Joya. John, you act a little bit, but you're mostly playing.
I'll call it that. I wouldn't
guitar. and also it's got a little bit of humor, especially the Andrew York Archimedes piece. So tell me a little bit about, let's start about your relationship with David Leisner. This is someone who, you know, I am assuming just based on the projects and the kind of recordings that you guys have done together, that you guys have really worked together well in the past and are going to continue to work with each other in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, so we go way back with David. I may have met him actually even before we moved to New York in 2000, but when we moved to New York, I sought him out to take lessons. So I actually studied with him for a few years in our first years in New York. And when Joya and I made our first CD called Quiet Songs, which was back in 2006, we recorded one of David's voice and guitar pieces. We like a lot of his vocal music. We think he just writes great vocal music. And so we recorded that for that CD. And then, you know, of course, I've been close with David over the years, a lot of contact with regard to, you know, the society and so on. And then back in around 2015, something like that, we asked him if he might write us a piece. And that led to a really great song cycle that he wrote for us called Eve's Diary, which we recorded shortly after that on our CD of the same name. We actually premiered that on Maui at Ben Verdery's class with David in attendance. He was the guest teacher that year. That was really, really special premiere we were able to have. And then when you know, everything happened here, and we decided to start making videos here during lockdown, we went back to one of his pieces because we just loved it so much and decided to do a video around that.
You know, as far as like his vocal writing, Joya, what is it? I mean, it does seem to fit into a pocket, into a tessitura, for lack of a better term. But do you feel that way with him? You seem very comfortable range-wise. Have you worked with him on, you know, exactly where that fits into your vocal range?
Oh, you mean on Eve's diary that he wrote for us?
Yeah, Eve's diary. And I don't know if he wrote this for you. Did he write Seagulls for you?
No, he didn't. Oh. But he did write Eve's diary for us. And yes, we discussed that with him. You know, I mean, it's really important that it fits. And it's also important, I think, with the guitar, I find it's better to be, for me, to be in a more mezzo-soprano range. Because of the balance between guitar and voice. The voice, you know, if you're going in an operatic direction, the voice can sort of be out of balance with the guitar the higher you go. So I like that mid-range for the intimacy and the balance.
And is that your natural range, is a mezzo-soprano?
I would call my voice type a soubrette. Soprano.
Oh, I like that. I've never heard that before. A soubrette piano, the soprano. That sounds nice.
Soprano, kind of a
is that named after me? it's a soubrette piano. Sorry, go ahead. You tell me the word again, and then we'll pick it.
Yeah, a soubrette soprano is a sort of a dime a dozen style soprano. You know, very light sounding soprano, maybe, you know, not with a really big upper range, just light. And I mean, I really haven't gone in that opera direction much in my career. So, but I mean, that would be a typical thing.
That would, so you kind of feel like that's more your range and you had to come down a little bit for this. But by coming down, you kind of felt like it seems like you were pretty comfortable. Or were you doing that more or less to fit with the guitar?
Yeah, I like being in that range. I think it's a good range for me and a good range for the balance. And I mean, you know, singing depends on where you're using the singing. If you're going to be having in front of an audience of who knows how many and a huge orchestra between you and them, then the range is different, right? The requirements are different.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that, you know, some of the, you know, guitar music that I played, like the Sorsegadias and stuff like that, those are written for mezzo-soprano, right? And people play the Schubert is arranged for mezzo-soprano oftentimes. So it is sort of a more typical range for us to work with.
Well, there's also just the issue of kind of the, you know, getting the words of the piece across, getting the lyrics across. And sometimes, even though, you know, the soprano voice can go quite high, sometimes that works at odds with understandability of the text, right? Way up in a high range, you know, I think it just can be harder to understand sometimes, harder to get it across, especially if you're coming from kind of more of an acting perspective. Sometimes that can feel unnatural to be up there in very high range, maybe higher volumes and things like that.
And that's true. And that definitely comes through in this. We are able to sort of discern every word, which you're right. That is sort of an issue with not just classical singing, but singing in general sometimes can sort of, the lyrics can get lost.
Right.
And there's a real importance, you know, in both pieces, one of them more humorous, one of them more poetic, you know, an actual setting of a poem by Leisner. And what is your relationship with Seagulls? This was not commissioned by you, but tell me about sort of what those lyrics meant to him from your understanding and what those lyrics mean to you.
Yeah. So we talked about him, about this recently with him. So he wrote the song cycle Outdoor Shadows back in the 80s. And then, you know, we heard it at some point way back then and decided years later we wanted to learn it and eventually record it. It's, I think, five movements on poems by Robert Francis, who isn't all that well known a poet, but one that David really thinks really highly of and says is really a very important nature poet. Kind of a contemporary of Robert Frost, but wasn't nearly as well known. And so all of the pieces in that set are really great. Seagulls is this very sort of simple, short poem with a very spare guitar part as accompaniment. And I think David has talked about the text being almost an artistic mantra for him. It has the line, the text talks about the seagulls being, you know, free and just so perfect in their movement. You couldn't improve on the arc of a seagull flying if you wanted to. And they attain something that which we may strive for but never seem to achieve, which is freedom that flows in form but still is free. And he really is attracted to that line, and I think did a beautiful setting, and we were really attracted to that piece and the whole set as well. And then for reasons we can get into, we thought that would be a really great piece to do a video to, especially during this time of the pandemic.
Wow, I didn't even think about that in terms of its relationship to what we're all going through now, which is isolation. And looking at that video, Joy, you do seem fairly isolated, and not to mention the fact that you just brought up a mantra, and there is a moment in the middle of the video where you are literally sitting there in lotus position, and looking up through the sky lamp. But that's is that in reference to sort of David's understanding of this as a mantra?
Actually, no. I don't think we had ever talked with him about that particular aspect of it prior to that. So that was.
But you guys read into it as well. You guys read into the fact that while you're saying these things, and it must often feel that way as a singer. I haven't talked to a singer, I believe. I may have, but I've forgotten. But in your case, Joy, I mean, I could really pick your brain about this. But is there a meditative quality to singing at all times, not just in the case of this?
I would say that, and it might be similar for a musician, performance is about being in the moment. It's about being present in the moment of what you're doing and not having your mind wandering on to anything else. You are all there all at once. And, I mean, it's true. If you're not there when you're acting, I don't. That's a miss. You can't do it that way. Your audience knows in a heartbeat. With singing, I find I need to do it that way, and I would expect really good. You guys know better than me. Good instrumental performance. It's probably the same.
I think that's the goal, right? You want to be present in it.
Right.
And often when you aren't and you take your focus off of it and you think of something else, that's where mistakes happen. That's where memory slips happen. That's where you just aren't in the music and aren't communicating it anymore. So I think that's absolutely the goal.
So, I mean, that's meditation, isn't it? Being in the moment.
It sure is. And that's true, because it is very tempting when you're performing to go towards an out-of-body experience, because, I mean, you are frightened up there and, you know, you are vulnerable, and it's very tempting to sort of just go into autopilot. Mm-hmm. But that's not, as you said, it's the goal more than it is the experience. The goal is to be a thinking musician on stage, or a thinking actor or a thinking performer, right? More likely. Going back to the videos, and that's an excellent point. But going back to the videos, and going back to that video in particular, sort of the setting for the video, the directing of that video. I understand that that Joya, you had done the directing for the second video, the Andrew York video, and I want to talk about that. But who directed the Seagull video?
Well, I think we.
Oh, you did?
Directed both of them. I mean, I came up with the concept for the Andrew York video, and then we jointly kind of came up for the concept of the Seagulls piece.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So we sort of jointly did that.
Right. We did both of these entirely on our own. I mean, this was all during the pandemic, so there was nobody else there to operate a camera or to direct it.
Sorry, I must have read something wrong. This is outstanding. These are both completely done by you guys during the pandemic?
Completely by us, yes.
Okay. Well, this is really outstanding work. I don't even understand how you, I mean, there's some special effects there.
Yeah.
There are, yes, yeah.
There's a lot, actually. This is really outstanding. What a renaissance coming. Now I'm really kind of taken aback. Seriously, with all respect, this is a beautiful thing. Looking at the video, the aspect of isolation in the first one, first of all, was the Seagull one completed before the Andrew York one? So that was kind of in the middle of, like, you guys had this concept in the middle of like literal isolation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like shortly into the pandemic, and we knew we were going to be locked down for a while.
Yeah.
And we had had some concerts that had been canceled, and we didn't know when we'd be able to perform in public again. We didn't know when we might get into a recording studio again. And we were just sort of scratching our heads, you know, what can we still do artistically? You know, we could sit here and rehearse things. That's great. But, you know, what can we do to still feel like we're doing something satisfying artistically and just kind of progressing? So we decided, well, let's make a video. We enjoy making those. We've made a few in the past. And since we, at that time, said, well, we can't really record, let's take one of our previous recordings. And it struck us that Seagulls was really appropriate to the pandemic because of this feeling of being shut inside, unable to do things.
They fly around
with complete freedom.
Enjoying life.
Right. Exactly. And normally we would have in the summer been, you know, going to the beach. We would have gone to, you know, to Hawaii and, you know, seeing birds and everything else there. And instead, you know, we're just shut inside. So we decided we would do that as kind of a step toward doing something artistic. And then we had to do it all ourselves. So we framed all of it around that idea of isolation, the feeling of isolation, the longing for freedom. So I don't know that we necessarily thought about it this way when we started out the project, but it certainly ended up being not a standard performance video, not, you know, the two of us sitting there together in a nice setting playing, which is great, and, you know, we've done that too. But we made it more of a story with Joy as the central character, as the one who's isolated and kind of expressing this longing for freedom.
And that's what it is. It is a longing for freedom. It is a longing to become Seagull.
Yeah.
as far as, you know, looking at the other video, the Andrew York video, this is a, you know, it starts out and, you know, you're on the bed, you're casually, which I'm sure you do, you must casually sort of paging through some Roman mathematical treatises on a Sunday morning while the rest of us are reading a New York Times like a bunch of plebs. And you're sitting there, you're doing your math. And then after that, you know, what happens? What occurs? What's the concept of this? You guys made all this up. I'm really interested in this.
Oh, yeah. Well, you want to know how I came up with the concept?
Or? Well, I guess we could start by just saying, did Andrew York write this for you?
Yes, he wrote this for us. Mm-hmm. We reached out to him. I mean, obviously, he's wonderful. Yeah. But also, it's really cool that we all have this hybrid science, music, art thing going on. Him and John and I, all three of us.
Oh, okay. So he's part of the... the cult of art science.
Yeah, he's really into math. I mean, he's really serious in his exploration of math concepts.
Wow.
You know, he posts things on his website, these really, really interesting analyses of problems and things like that. I mean, really, really, he thinks about it very deeply. And so he in himself is kind of this, you know, combination, this marriage of music and math. And then we both have science or math backgrounds, and so we reached out to him because, you know, we thought he'd be great to write a piece like this. So he did write the piece for us on a poem that he had written before about Archimedes, who he really admires. And we actually had not recorded the piece prior to the pandemic, so we did that here at home as well. And then Joya came up with this great concept for the video.
So yeah, as far as you had, so this was recorded by you, and then the video portion of it was the concept. And what is the concept?
Oh, I came up with this concept about it was going to be an adventure that my character was going to take, and then I was going to meet this. This fascinating guitarist on my bench.
I know he's that's what it is. That's what's happening.
And then I wanted to have you question: is this a dream or is this real or what happened here?
Right. And that does that sort of interplay into the idea of the math and the art, sort of this gray area, you know, the math and music sort of coming together and, you know, because it's a real sort of like, it is dreamlike in that way, but also just the entire concept is dreamlike. Whenever you sort of try to marry, which I'm sure you guys must be attracted to that element of it, coming from your background and being where you are now, there must be some sort of fascination with where those two come together and then sort of, I would assume, just sort of dissolve into each other.
Yeah, I guess we conceived of this piece, this ultimate mashup,
right?
Math, art, science, math, art, music, science thing.
And we were just looking for a fun way to tell this story. The story is this very well-known story of Archimedes discovering a principle, you know, of physics, of math, you know, when he steps into the bathtub and running out into the street shouting Eureka. So we wanted to tell that story, but didn't want it to just be kind of a straight performance of that, just a straight recitation of the story. So we decided we would layer this other element on top of it and have her character be going through her own story as she kind of becomes part of the math within the story.
It is so hard to do. And I don't think people do give people who try, and in this case succeed, to sort of take something, you know, this is a relatively, from a theoretical standpoint, this is a real piece of music. This is a kind of a complex, it's got atonal elements in it. It's not a light, you know, easy to, you know, follow all the way through piece of music. It's a composition of new music. And to be able to take that and be able to take sort of the stress of performing something well, add to that everything that goes with recording, that goes with making a video, and then try to kind of be irreverent or humorous about it. I don't think people give enough credit to people trying to do something like that. Mm-hmm. It really, really is difficult to you know, as you guys know, to be funny on stage. You know, it's not any of that stuff. Yeah. So, you know, the fact that you're able to do that, it must have been at times you must have doubted yourself or felt silly. But, you know, then how do you get through that?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, this was really a major effort to get this all right. Yeah. And get the timing. Comedy depends on yeah. timing, right? And having the shots just perfect. And you know, I won't say we got all the shots perfect the first time. Sometimes we had to go back and redo because we realized, wait a minute, this is not going to work for what we're trying to do here.
Yeah.
But I mean, Joy is the expert on comedy on stage. She can probably say more about that. how to perform.
Oh my gosh.
In a comic way.
Yeah, that's a big box for you. I mean, you have, you know, a one-woman show that I understand was, you know, went, you know, really viral and you had a lot of success with, about being a female mathematician at MIT.
Right.
And you know, so sort of, yeah, comedy, working comedy into high art. would be something that I think John is sort of pointing to you and saying, explain to Brett how we do that.
Well, I kind of, as an art form, my first art form is definitely acting. Mm. That's my main thing for years. So it's kind of par for the course. You have to know how to do that or you know, either or just avoid it and stick to drama, straight ahead drama. But most people who are in that art form, I find, know a little about how to handle comedy on stage. So, yeah. You know, and then it comes with being in front of audience after audience after audience too, and your training and your technique. So, what can I say? It's not a very exciting or fun.
No, it is. It's relatively exciting because we just, you know, as classical guitarists, we aren't graced with these elements very often. And when we are, they don't always work. It's sometimes it's forced, you know, it can be a very dry, you know, performance sometimes. And not just with classical guitar, with classical music and a lot of music in general. It's hard. It's hard because it is, you know, these songs are about serious things, and we're here for a very serious reason. But the importance of comedy certainly seems to have, you know, been acknowledged by the dramatists, which you, you know, came up with. And tell me about that journey. Were you acting, you know, a lot in high school before you went to college?
Oh, yeah, I started as a kid. So, right. So you know, a lifelong thing. And definitely before college, and then college, and then then I tried to pivot completely into mathematics and just stick to that and not do anything artistic at all.
Yeah.
Because it took a lot of energy to do mathematics. And eventually
you're
that
me.
Yeah, it didn't work out for me. I couldn't do that. So.
Why couldn't you do that? So it seems like you could because you went to MIT, which just, by virtue of being there, it seems like you had an ability to sort of get straight A's, sort of pass any math test. But so what was it? You know, I mean, I know that you could probably just say, well, why don't you just watch the show, which is true. But was it that? Was it sort of a male culture that drove you away from mathematics, or was it just sort of like not feeling like it was your calling?
You know, it was such a confusing time. I really never understood it. At one point, I just felt like I don't fit in here.
Hmm.
I'm not welcome here.
Ugh.
I need to leave here.
That's what it felt like to be that at that time.
At that time, at MIT and in math, and I, at that time, I decided that it was probably my fault I felt that way, and that I should just leave. I had no idea that many women have felt that way. I had absolutely no idea. And then I sort of put that away, and I started keeping a journal at one point after I put both feet in the arts. It was hard finding my way after that, but I started to journal and I started to write about my experiences in math, not thinking that it was anything but a journal. And eventually that became the play that's been so popular. I was reluctant to share what I had written. I thought maybe it was too dangerous or incendiary or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I had writing buddies who sort of said, hey, you've got to do this. So anyway, I made it into a play and it became popular and I started to tour it. And I would have all these women come up to me afterwards and say, oh my God, you're telling my story.
Yeah.
So I found out that way that this was widespread, this feeling of not belonging, not fitting in, not being welcome amongst women that I talked to. So that was an eye-opener. And I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah,
but
you did.
Yeah.
Is, you know, so coming off of that and going into the arts, did you feel more welcome?
I always felt the arts, I felt welcome in the arts, yes.
Right.
I didn't have that same problem, but then, you know, let's face it, there's many more women. The balance of women and men in the arts is
pretty
way better than math.
Yeah, better. Not perfect, especially in our little line here. We're working on. I mean, I think John can probably, you know, anybody who's been involved with classical guitar this long can see the difference. I mean, when I went to school, there was one girl in the class.
I think it's better. I mean, we mm-hmm. certainly have tried.
There's a lot of work to do.
We have work to do. I think at the Society in New York, we've made an effort to do that, but it's certainly not a 50-50 split. And when you look at composers, it's dismal, the number of female composers that get played on programs. So, you know, there's definitely areas where we're doing better. There's areas where we just really have to do much, much better. You know, the issue of underrepresentation of female composers, I think, is something that we just all sort of know and assume without, you know, without ever actually counting things up. I've given a talk a couple times now, recently at the Society and a couple times before that, where I analyze the programs at the Society for the past 13 seasons. And one thing that falls out of that is how, you know, 95% of the programs are all male composers, and, you know, maybe 2% of 1% or 2% of the programs are all female composers, and then you have a handful of them that have maybe one female composer on the program. When you do that kind of analysis, you see just how serious the problem is. So, you know, I think that's something really for artists to think about and us as presenters to think about when we're programming. You know, how can we start shifting that? In terms of you know, performers and composers of color, that's a major issue as well. And I think we need to just do a whole lot better on that as well. I think those conversations are still very much alive, but still just sort of starting in many ways.
Yeah, they are just starting. And I mean, the show is not, you know, obviously, you know, we're talking about a show where the vast majority of people on here have been, you know, white males. So it's not something that, you know, just it's a situation that, yeah, that we're just starting to address.
Yeah.
Joya, coming out of, you know, MIT, and John, I'm sorry, did you go to MIT as well? Or you did? Is that where you guys met?
No.
We met in high school.
What?
We met in high school. Yeah, I know.
You guys are high school? You guys have been together that long?
Yeah. High school sweethearts, yep.
I'm sure you talked about that on the first episode, but that was, you know, 8 years ago. So how can I be responsible? But so you guys are high school sweethearts. That's the sweetest thing I've ever heard. How have you guys not killed each other yet?
The pandemic, I mean, you guys, is really a test.
You guys seem to have a relatively sort of romantic and respectful relationship with each other. How do you maintain that? There's no way. I love my parents, mom and dad. I love you. But you do want to kill each other, and we all know it. You guys aren't that way. What's going on there? Give us some tips and tricks.
We each met the right person. I don't know.
Oh, that's beautiful. And so you guys came through this, and you were with her through that whole struggle when she left MIT.
Yeah, we were grad students together. So, I mean, it was particularly hard on her through that time. But, you know, it's not easy for anybody in grad school.
I think it's amazing that the two of you got into the same school. That's sort of a hard thing. Yeah, yeah. That must have been a scary moment when one of you... Did you guys get the acceptance letter at the same time, or did one of you get it a day before and the other one just had to sit there and stare?
Way back into ancient history. I have no idea.
No.
Probably different times, because departments handle things on different schedules. So one of us must have had to wait to see.
One of you was like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with my life? But Joya, that would have been, you know, you would have been able to continue acting. And as far as the singing is concerned, you do have a lovely voice. How was that developed? What was your relationship coming up with that? Did you have not just a coach, but it seems like you must have been involved in some sort of, was it just musical theater, or are we talking about some classical stuff?
Oh, I started training my voice when I was 16.
Right.
So I had years and years and years and years and years and years of classical voice training.
Before doing these videos.
Yeah. So, I mean, I started training as an actor for real, maybe. I'd say really got into it after MIT. Mm-hmm. Or during MIT, to be honest.
Really? Well, there's no acting program at MIT, right? Is there?
No, I talk about this in my show. It was so crazy. I started sneaking across the river to, like, the conservatories to...
That's right.
To take lessons in singing and acting and dance. I did a BU program, and I did private education as well. So... and I would sneak over there when I was really supposed to be at MIT.
That's right. There is kind of a river, you know, that separates the arts and the, for lack of a better word, intellectuals. You know, Harvard and MIT are on one side of the river. And all the artists and pinkos are on the other side of the river. But that's so that's kind of a fun story. That's neat. So you would go over there and sort of sing and act at BU.
Yeah,
Boston Conservatory.
Yeah, I did private lessons. I did conservatory kind of lessons and programs in Boston. Then we moved to back to the West Coast for a while, and then I continued my education. And mostly privately. So that's how I did it. And then I had the great good fortune of when we came to New York, I got into Wynn Hanman's studio. He was, we lost him in the pandemic, actually, sadly. He was legendary acting coach and teacher. He taught, everybody you admire, Denzel Washington.
His name was Len Handman?
Wynn Hanman, yeah. Wynn, you can look up his obituary in the Times recently. He died of the COVID. And there's a new documentary about him and his contributions to theater, which is terrific. I think it's called, what's it called? It takes... I forget it. I remember.
You forget the name of it.
Forgetting the name. I went to the premiere. It was wonderful.
What about, you know, what is it when you have a great sort of theater or you know, performance? What can you sort of give us something from that? I kind of feel like we should all, as performers, have... I've said this privately, I think, but I think that we should have to take some sort of public speaking class or some sort of... We need some sort of performance, curriculum in the conservatories that allows us to get on stage, not just practice all day, get on stage, either piss our pants or not, and then, you know, we have a career or we don't. So it's like, I think that, you know, that would be something that the listeners would like hearing. Is there something that he was able to tell you about getting into a moment, getting into a character?
Huh.
Accepting your faults, vulnerability, all the things that seem to be part of great acting.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah, well, it was all in his studio. It's all about the character you're playing, which, is a different deal. But I suppose if I did used to wonder if a musician could be helped by that that approach. Sometimes if you feel uncomfortable as yourself on stage, you can feel completely comfortable as a character.
Yeah.
You know, like, and so if you don't have a character to play, you can build one to represent yourself.
Right.
I don't know if that makes any sense, but I mean, he would talk to me about that actually. When I was creating my play that's been popular, it's called Truth Values. It was just such a magnificent experience to work with him, and he talked to me a lot about John Leguizamo, who had some terrific one-man shows. He's quite well known. And when he worked with him, he would tell me about how John, he said, that was uncomfortable as himself, or he didn't sparkle as himself on stage, but when he had a character to play, he was beyond compare. So what they did was build a character for him to represent himself. You know,
right,
what I mean?
So he sort of plays the East Lower East Side Puerto Rican guy. You know, that's John Leguizamo's character. Whereas he also plays Toulouse-Lautrec. at some point. So this is obviously, you know, that he can do those kinds of things. But the idea of retreating into a character, now that's something that I think people could sort of, you know, understand and even utilize on stage. The idea that if you are, like, you don't have to be everything. You can sort of create a character. And some of the best performers, whether they're classical soloists, I mean, we see that. We see that, you know, a bravado to it and stuff. That has to be there, right?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know what... It depends on what suits you.
Mm.
But that might be a way to approach it if a musician has an affinity to creating a character, which is a whole other little art form there.
Ziggy Stardust, right? Ziggy Stardust on classical guitar. as far as, you know, John, getting into becoming a classical guitarist, were your studies with David Leisner was that the first time? I mean, I know you must have studied it before, but was that your first time in an academic setting?
Well, I mean, all of it was private study anyway. So, I mean, I didn't go to conservatory and study with David. And I had studied actually, you know, well, going way back to when I was in college, you know, private lessons with various teachers during grad school. I also would run across the river to Boston Conservatory for lessons with Neil Anderson way back when he was there. Peter Clemente I studied with for a bit in Boston. David, I mean, that really felt like, you know, kind of really significant teacher that I had. You know, I studied with him for a few years, and it was all, you know, private lessons, but it was just really significant for me in terms of sort of, I would say, sort of making my technique much better and just learning from him as a musician. I just think he is such a fine teacher, and I think I had a great, you know, solid background before that, but I think it was really, for me, transformative to study with David.
Yeah, he certainly immerses himself in it. I mean, mm-hmm. he is living and breathing.
Yeah,
the classical music mm-hmm. lifestyle. Yeah. He's in it, and he's constantly in it.
Yeah,
and that must have been really effective.
Such a clear teacher as well. I mean,
he is. Yeah, definitely.
I think I just really clicked with his style of teaching because I felt like everything just made sense. You know, there was always a great and well-articulated reason behind everything that you need to do in terms of, you know, how you use your body appropriately, how you, you know, have appropriate freedom in your movement and things like that. And it all just made sense and seemed to come from a very good understanding, you know, physiological understanding and things like that. And he could just communicate that as well as the artistic ideas. So I really think I responded really well.
I would imagine that would click with somebody who had been like, you know, in sort of the sciences and the maths, where it's like this plus this equals this. And yeah. I have studied a little bit with David Leiser, and I know that, you know, that's his approach is very detailed and very, he does have reasons for why he does everything he does. Yeah. And that's something that he can share, that he can articulate, and that he's really thought about. So right. I can imagine that would really click with someone.
Right.
You know, of sort of your disposition.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then sort of when you work with a singer, what do you take into account as a performer or as a, you know, as an interpreter, more importantly? Like what sort of things? I know that with me, when I had a girlfriend in college, my high school sweetheart, we didn't work out, but in college we played together. She's an incredible mezzo-soprano. Old Amy Bouchard there. We're still buddies. Uh-huh. And she and I remember her teacher said, I was trying to sort of play around with tone a lot at that time. And I was sort of getting, you know, dry and warm. And her teacher was like, can you keep it more stable? It's hard for her to mm-hmm. sort of figure out where you're at mm-hmm. and sort of do what she's doing. So what kinds of things do you sort of find when you're playing with a singer? And this can go both ways. I mean, we've already sort of breached the subject a little bit with Joya, but from a guitarist's point of view, what is it like working with a singer?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's something I really enjoy. I mean, I really like ensemble playing in general, but I think accompanying a singer is sort of its own thing. You have to be very much, you know, obviously in your music, in your part, but you have to be so attuned to what the singer is doing. You know, I don't want to say more than if you're playing with, you know, another guitarist or, you know, another instrumentalist, but you have to be so aware of their breath and their phrasing and be able to support that at all times. And they may not sing it the same way each time, right? They may be in the moment, in the character, and it may come out in a different way. And I think you have to be, you know, ready to kind of meet them where they are, because it doesn't matter what the guitar part is like, no matter how complicated it is or how flashy or something, you're still, the singer is the star, and you're supporting that. And the singer is basically taking the lead, or that should be the way it is, I think. So, you know, I find it fun. I find it, that there's actually just a lot that you have to be thinking about when you're playing. You have to be just, you know, in the music, but very much attuned to them, and trying to synthesize all that at the same time.
Yeah, that is definitely something that you learn. And a lot of these pieces are written, especially by the new music composers. I wouldn't assume that, you know, David and Andrew are writing things that are unplayable, but I've had experiences where, you know, I've gotten involved with a commissioned piece once or twice, and mm-hmm. and it's just, you know, really hard to play, and the singer's sort of doing their own thing, and then
right.
before we know it, we're off.
Right. Yeah.
But Joya, kind of moving over to you, playing with a guitarist. This is a, you know, something that, especially if you come from musical theater, or even if you're doing classical music and you're singing Fauré and Schubert and, you know, and everything, and you can depend on that piano being as loud or as soft, or, you know, you can depend on it being articulated in certain ways. And, you know, there's something standard about being a piano accompanist that doesn't come naturally to the guitarist all the time. And it's something that needs to be, as John just said, cultivated. But in your case, what are sort of the, you know, good things and bad things? Please, and bad things about being with a guitar. You already said that it's good to kind of come down range-wise, and you feel more comfortable in the mezzo realm. But what else have you kind of run into? Because you've been doing this for years now, too. This isn't new to you.
Yeah, with guitar. It is. I mean, I think it's a lot easier to sing with an orchestra or a piano. Yeah. Way easier.
An orchestra. Okay.
Oh, sure.
Wow. I wouldn't imagine that would be difficult.
No, I mean, there's so much support, you know, you have so much sound, so much support to what you're doing. But when you're with the guitar, such a quiet instrument that doesn't have today the words are going out of my head. You know, the carrying on of the music, right?
The sustain.
It doesn't have the sustain. So, you know, it's almost, sometimes I joke that singing with a guitar is almost a cappella.
Sorry, I just spit my coffee a little.
We're sitting there struggling like crazy to play, and she doesn't even know we're there.
Yeah, just doing her thing.
Yeah. If you're going to sing with the guitar, maybe you better make sure that you could also sing it a cappella.
That's right, because you're not going to be able to hear us. So that's the truth. But yeah, so you're talking a lot, you know, and that's something that it always comes up with us is volume. Sustain is definitely one thing, but the volume is something that singers, I just see them kind of go like, do I need to be quieter? Because you guys are told to belt it out, to just, you know, to let it go, you know. And I'm not saying that not to sing softly, but I'm saying that your dynamic range, you know, has to be affected by the guitar
and
in a frustrating way.
Singing softly is not exactly that easy necessarily.
Yeah.
So if you have to sing softly all the time, that's really not easy. And if you have to sing really high and softly, that's even harder.
Right. So, yeah. And when you're doing the recordings, do you approach it? How do you approach your recordings? Do you approach it where John does his part first, or do you guys record at the same time? Because that is an option in your case, you know, where you guys can do track recording.
Right. We've done it every way. First CD we made, we did it in real time together, but we were isolated in separate booths in the recording studio, which we actually in the end found, I think, kind of hard to deal with because we're so used to sitting, you know, close and, you know, hearing the breath and seeing the visual cues. And when they're off someplace else, the other one is hard to do that. But of course, it gives you more flexibility in the edit because you can isolate parts and choose takes from one or the other. Right. Second CD we did in a studio sitting next to each other. So, you know, you live or die together on those takes. it makes for a lot more interesting discussions about which takes are acceptable.
Oh. That's what I would see I would see her just going like, I think it's fine. And you're like,
there was a buzz. I buzzed that note. Didn't even notice.
She's like, no one cares.
And then we've also done what you say with, like, you know, doing the backing track first, and then she can just do, you know, her takes on top of that. And it depends on the piece what works best. I think our preference is to do it more like a performance where we're playing together, and then we just, you know, do a lot of takes and try it different ways. But sometimes it makes sense to do it with the backing track, basically.
Yeah, it's got to be a piece by piece basis as far as what makes sense, and then you got to take into account the entire package. Well, so as far as what's on the table for this Saturday, I'm going to try and get this out as soon as possible. So I'm going to try and get this out in the next day or two so that people can be ready for this. But as far as what's on the table for this Saturday, I think we're going to talk about that, and then we're going to part ways for the day, if that's all right. But what can people expect?
Well, so we'll premiere these two videos, but we're also showing one other video that we made last year in a more conventional way with a couple of camera operators and somebody else doing the editing. And that's a video we made to the piece Bring Him Home from Les Mis, which was arranged for us as a set of theater songs, so arranged for us by Clarice Assad. And we shot that in a beautiful old theater, really just stunningly beautiful in terms of how the videographer made that. Simon Yu is the guy who made that and just did a beautiful job of filming it and editing it. So we're going to start showing that. And prior to that, we talk with our good friend Andrew Dickinson, previous president of the society.
That's right, my buddy. Yeah.
You know him? Yeah, absolutely. So he chats with us a little bit about the making of that. And then we go on to the other two videos, which we're kind of showing as premieres on Saturday. And we start with discussion with each of the composers. So we chat with David a little bit about setting texts and this Seagulls text in particular. We talk with Andy York a little bit about math and how he sees math and music interacting. Andrew Dickinson talks with us a little more about the behind the scenes making of each of these videos. So it'll be about a 40-minute program, a little behind the scenes chat, and then three videos that you get to see. And then hopefully people will come over and join us for a reception afterwards on Zoom, and we can talk directly.
Oh, wow, that's so exciting. What a complete package.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like a box set.
Everything you could want in one 40-minute package.
And it's only 40 minutes with a reception?
That'll be afterwards.
Well, yeah.
So you're going to do the two videos, three videos, a discussion with Andrew and David, and then Andrew Dickinson is going to talk, sort of do a little Q&A with you guys.
Q&A before each video, yeah.
Sounds great. Well, it's been wonderful catching up with you.
Great.
You too. I think that people should know that we do run into each other at parties and stuff. We are friends. I consider you guys friends.
Absolutely. And and we occasionally see you at society events. So.
Oh, no. Yes, you do. And you know what? I really, I am getting to the point in my life, and I've said this before, but I almost wrote, I think I was talking to Colin Davin the other day, and I was saying, I think I'm really, especially with the isolation, I have friends. I have plenty of friends that I love, but man, I'm starting to really hurt for just casual discussions with people who understand music at this level. So I get it from the podcast, but there's something different about having this sort of warmth and warm element of having that family around. And I think it really just it takes me a long time to come around to realizations like that. I'm a slow learner. So I hope to see you at more of these things once we open back up.
Can't wait. Yes. I agree.
Absolutely. And Joya, thanks again for joining us and all your insight as far as being a singer is concerned. Are you tired of going to classical guitar concerts?
Oh no!
She can't get enough.
Well, I remember that's God bless him, our departed friend Frank Wallace. Miss him, lovely guy, one of the best guys I ever had on the show, and he, I hope I'm not outing him in any way, but he told me when we were having sandwiches once, he said that Nancy says the best part about moving out of the city is that she doesn't have to go to guitar class every single weekend. So I hope you don't mind, Frank, that I'm bringing that up. But, we all appreciate it. We all appreciate your sacrifice. But they are great concerts. You have seriously, it's a great schedule. It's a great society. It's a great group of people. And it's led to the success and support of a lot of us, myself included. So thank you, John, for all of that. And thank you, Joya, for everything that you're doing for the instrument, too. People that don't play the guitar do a lot of really important things for it. And we appreciate your, you know, your lending of your talents to our art, Joya.
Wow, thank you.
You got it, no problem. Thanks a lot for joining me, guys.
Thank you, Brett. This was great. Great to talk to you.